Good afternoon and welcome to the panel, RNZ National. Anthea says, I have three Gen Z kids and they all purchase books from bookstores, use Goodreads app to record and recommend books, and at the moment they are all reading Vintage Murakami. With us this afternoon, Alexia Russell, journalist and producer for The Detail, and Simon Pound, Ingrid Starnes, co-founder and business podcaster and consultant. Well, from today, Tamariki can receive two doses of the children's version of the Pfizer vaccine. Almost 500,000 New Zealand children will be eligible for COVID-19 vaccination from today when criteria widen to include 5 to 11-year-olds. Children will need those two doses at least 8 weeks apart. Children have made up 20% of the infections in New Zealand's Delta outbreak, according to the numbers from the Ministry of Health, and 7% of those who required hospital treatment. And if you have a question for our next guest, email us or text us pretty quickly, 2101, we'll try and sneak it in. And that guest is vaccinologist Dr. Helen Patousis-Harris. Kia ora to you, Dr. Patousis-Harris.
Oh, kia ora.
So this is understandably a big step forward in further protecting the population.
It is. This is a good significant proportion of our community. And when we're facing Omicron, I think it's going to be really additionally important to try and get this community as protected as possible to face it.
A few key questions and a couple of key questions coming through, and I'll address them. Is the vaccine as effective in children as it is for adults? And how protected are they after that first dose?
That's a really good question because from what we can see so far, yes, absolutely. And they do tend to respond really well to vaccines at this age. At the moment, though, to see how effective it is, you actually need a little bit of time to go past to be able to accumulate that knowledge. Remember, right back at the beginning when we were just rolling these vaccines out, and we've still got to wait a little while to see exactly how effective. But at looking pretty consistent with our that next age group, the 12 to 17s, which is better than those of us who are older.
Yeah. Dr. Jin Russell said that people could be reassured any serious side effects are incredibly rare, and you'd side with that assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, they're actually significantly rarer in this younger age group than they are in that next 12 to 17-year-old age group. So I think probably if we were to compare across all ages, this age group actually has one of the lowest rates of serious events. Yeah. So I think, too, they also get a third the dose. They don't get the same dose.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Now, we have a panel with us. Alexia, your questions and thoughts. And I know that you did a podcast on The Detail about this very issue back in November, I think.
Yeah, we did on the 15th of November with Jin Russell in it, actually. And it was a really interesting one to listen to because, you know, the three people we spoke to who were in the professions all had children. And, you know, there is a leap of faith when someone says to you, this vaccine is safe. With yourself, you feel like you can take a risk and you shouldn't, you need to do it. But with your children, there's that extra worry, you know, is this really safe? Am I doing something that could harm my children? But the overwhelming now, there's something to be said about coming in behind the rest of the world, evidence is that it is. But I do understand why parents might be a little more hesitant about immunising their children than they were about immunising themselves.
Helen?
Yes, sorry.
Alexia was just saying you can understand because at the end of the day, there is a little bit of a leap of faith when you're vaccinating someone else. Do you expect some parents to be on the fence about the children's vaccines? Is that to be expected?
Absolutely. You know, we have a whole spectrum in the community of people who are going to be knocking down the door to get their kids in first, and those who are just going to be a lot more hesitant, they want to wait and see, etc. So I completely understand as a parent, how that feels.
Yeah. Before we bring Simon in, just one from here. A grandma asks a question regarding kids under 12 COVID vax. Is it likely that, for example, like adults, a four-month booster will also be needed? Mum wondering if she should delay vaccination for Master 6 until Omicron is actually out in the community, so cover lasts longer. Could your expert discuss this, please?
I think given that Omicron will be here any day, probably, chances are, and you're not actually going to get that protection from vaccine doses until you've really had those two doses. So you've got a couple of months. If you went out today, there's more than a couple of months before you're going to actually be protected, you know, reasonably well. And that's going to sustain you for a wee while. So I don't think that I wouldn't recommend delaying at this stage.
Okay, so no delaying. And just on the back of that, my child turns 12 in 3 weeks' time. She's small for her age. Is it better for her to get the paediatric dose now or wait and get the adult dose on her birthday on the 6th of Feb? What would give her better protection?
You know, looking, I mean, that's really probably one we can't answer. You know, drawing a line there is quite difficult. But it is more about the maturity of the immune system, not necessarily the size of the person. So, again, coming back to that, this virus is knocking down the door at the moment. It might be good to go and get it started.
That message of don't delay. Okay, Simon.
Yeah, and to that point, we have a nine-year-old who we'll be taking this week to get that first dose. As I think, just to kind of like push on that don't delay message, my understanding is, and I'd love your thoughts, Doctor, is that even one dose is an extraordinarily helpful thing to have under the belt if Omicron does get into the community between the 8 weeks that are recommended between doses. Having one is extraordinarily better than zero.
Absolutely. As soon as you, probably from about, you know, the first couple of weeks after your first dose, you know, your journey really starts to begin and you start to reduce your risk from that point on and then again after your second dose. So it's really just a spectrum, really, of how much protection you're getting over time.
Now, this notion, Simon, keep going.
Oh, sorry. And does the biggest gain come from that first dose?
Yeah, I guess the thing that happens as soon as you're exposed is that you start to, you know, your immune response starts, and that takes time, and that actually matures over a lot of months. So that actually starts with the first dose, gets another little push along with the second dose. It's actually when you come along later, after it's matured, several months later, that with a booster, that then you get quite an explosion of that protection again. So it's very much a spectrum that occurs over a period of quite a few months.
Now, another one here, COVID, the study came out actually just very, very recently, Helen, COVID-19 is not just a quote-unquote mild infection for our tamariki. This is according to a new international study on children who caught the virus, and that has been sort of in the round about that it is just a mild infection. But can you expand on this international study on children just a bit?
Well, I think we've tended to focus so much on the adults, particularly the older ones, because, you know, there's no doubt about it, they're the ones that are hit the hardest on average. But nobody is complete, you know, no particular part of our community is completely exempt. And we've sort of left the kids to one side. Now, you know, they actually can get quite sick. We've seen they can go to hospital, they can go to intensive care, and there have been really some deaths associated with it. Also, those less severe effects, like, you know, having long COVID, having that long-term fatigue, having a lot of time feeling unwell, all of that other stuff and the impact on the family. So there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on with kids that we kind of need to think about, not just whether or not they land in intensive care or something like that.
Yep. Now, finally, in terms of Omicron knocking at our door, as you said, and the fact that it's a matter of when, it could be any time now rather than if, what is the most pressing concern for you at the moment with Omicron coming?
I guess in part I'm feeling good because we have made so much progress. We're in good shape with our vaccines and trying to get those boosters away as fast as possible. But also worried that we still aren't going to have enough time to, get as many of our children, our tamariki, vaccinated as we can. If it comes tomorrow, it's here. And we're going to have to try and get a slow burn rather than having it go whoosh.
Lovely to have you on the program. Thank you for your time. That is vaccinologist Dr. Helen Patousis-Harris. Just in terms of that anxiety aspect, because I know, Alexia, a lot of people are feeling this with knowing that it will happen and it's coming anytime soon. Do you have a little bit of underlying anxiety about that, or how are you feeling about it, Alexia?
I do, in that it's really hard to get a podcast out when you're not in the sanctity of the RNZ office with all the bells and whistles and the wonderful recording and the sound. And we managed to do it by working out from the newsroom office last year for months. And I feel like I've had enough of that. And I really want to be back into the office doing what we do best with the best equipment and the best people. And I just feel this sense of a black cloud of not, coming towards me, of that might not happen. That's what worries
me. Since you're facing another, at least part of the year, not being in an office. Here we go again, Simon Pound.
Yeah, I think if you look at what's happened in Australia, where they have fantastic rates of vaccination and fantastic rates of boosters compared to where we're sitting at the moment, things are very difficult there. So I think, as as the experts are saying, if it does get out, it's going to be a really rough ride. But what I really hope is that, everyone's fatigued and everyone's over it and everyone just wants it to not be a thing anymore. But I hope that we can keep together and keep listening to the experts and not take this fatigue and frustration out on, the leaders and the medical professionals and the people, and just stick together.
4:18, the panel. RNZ National, back with you, 2022. In other news, at more than $100 a term and long wait lists, swimming lessons are a massive financial burden for families, Water Safety Chief Executive Daniel Gerard has told Stuff. This summer, more than 30 people have died since the beginning of December, even more than the total for all of last summer, and the worst number of drownings in more than 40 years. So do we need to put more of an emphasis on swimming lessons and help with the cost for those that aren't able to afford them? With us is Auckland Swim School Swimtastic owner Mark Bone, who happens to be a former Olympic swimming trainer. Kia ora, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, Mark. First up, mention must be made of this dreadful summer of water-related deaths. Some heartbreaking stories this season, weren't there?
Oh, look, when you're in the industry and when you've been in the industry for as long as I have, this is frightening. And it's a shocking statistic. I mean, 30, as you said, in this holiday period. Gosh, if you look at it since that July period of COVID, and we talk about that, we've only had 26 deaths. And look at what COVID's cost us, but we're not putting the investment into swimming lessons. And we're not actually helping this whole scenario of ensuring that kids are, in inverted commas, drown-proof for future generations. And it's just, it frustrates me, it annoys me, but it's one of those statistics at the moment. We've said all along, because of lockdown and us and our industry not being able to do our job, we're going to have a generation of kids that aren't going to be able to swim effectively or well.
Okay, so a few years back, there was an Otago University study involving 8th and Eden schools, found that 2/3 of children were unable to swim 100 metres. That was a few years ago. Now, I'm not quite sure how much has that changed, but how do you see this issue? What needs to change?
First and foremost, it hasn't changed. 100 metres isn't enough anyway, because I don't believe personally that anybody is safe in the ocean if they can't swim 800 metres because of...
800 metres?
Absolutely, because you get caught in a tide and you go out there, it might only be 300 metres out offshore, but it's 300 out, 300 back. Mm. It's also fighting the tide. So unless you can swim to that degree and competently to that level, you're not going to be safe. Now, we've got, you know, we've got 7, 8, 9-year-old kids all swimming that distance in our swim school, and I know that they have all around the country. But those are kids that are actually getting the lessons and learning to swim competently and properly as well. So what's going to have to change? I mean, there's a whole host of things that has to change. I mean, we're lucky we have a purpose-built facility, which we did a big investment in and a privately run. And we, you know, we have people that come to us because they feel confident with what we're doing. But you have a lot of people that are lower socioeconomic and they can't afford lessons. And we've got to make sure that we help that lower socioeconomic grouping and also different demographics as well of ethnic backgrounds. That's really important because, you know, the different ethnic backgrounds don't always put the same emphasis on the importance of learning to swim and swim competently. And how do you put a dollar value on a death? You can't. You know, so you've got to spend some money. It's the price of a life that we're talking about, and we don't want to have any death.
Alexia Russell.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And in New Zealand, where we have so much water, this should be a no-brainer, you know, to teach our kids to swim. But, you know,
Can you swim 800 metres?
Oh, yeah, I'm a good swimmer. Oh. That would not be a problem for me. But I think that, and also, you know, I had to teach my little one because I took him to swimming lessons and he just decided that life under the water was better than on top of it. So I eventually had to teach him. But, I mean, as well as, you know, making swimming lessons affordable, for some people they will never be affordable. So I think we need to have a look at what we teach kids about the water. You know, don't leap into a river just because your mates do. Don't drink and swim. Currents, rips, tides. You know, there needs to be this to go hand in hand with a bit of education, you know, maybe sort of aimed at the place you live in, you know, whether you like here in Beachhaven where all the kids jump off the wharf, but there's a heck of a current running through the bottom of the wharf. Most of them seem to know by assimilation, but some don't. That sort of local knowledge needs to be taught to them somewhere, somehow, whether it's by mum and dad or the schools.
Look, swimming is fantastic. You know, you've got to go back first and foremost and look at why do we teach kids to swim? One, we want to have safety in it, but also as people get older, it's health and well-being and it's non-weight bearing. So it's a, you know, it's a skill for life. And I think we have to acknowledge that as well. So coming back to it, we probably do need to address all of those issues that Alexia just talked about in the school environment. And we're not doing that. The importance of what do rips do, what do currents do, what should you do if you get into trouble and out of your comfort zone, whether it be in a swimming pool, whether it be in the ocean or a lake. But we also have to make sure that parents take personal responsibility as well in keeping and ensuring that their children are safe and that they've got their eyes on them 24/7 when they're in water.
Here's one. For goodness sake, I grew up on the Canadian prairies and we had school swimming for 5 to 6, all aimed at survival. And I want to put it out there right now to the listeners. Do you think that you could swim 800 metres? Text us 2101, yes or no. Simon, I don't think that I could. In fact, I know that right now I couldn't swim 800 metres. How do you see this issue?
Well, I'm lucky because I was taken to lessons. And in fact, it's the same place, Ross Miller in Three Kings, that we're now taking our kids for their lessons. And it's like a time warp. It's the same people in the same room. And it's they're really wonderful people. But we're lucky, you know, like we can afford the $100 a term or whatever it might be. And we can afford the time to take the kids over there. But I think for lots of people who can't, you know, it needs to be a bigger part of the curriculum. The fact that, according to the story that, you know, these stats were shared in, you know, there's 8 hours or so of swimming instruction for schools. It does seem that when water is such a big part of enjoying New Zealand, maybe we could push to have more of an understanding of not just the dangers of swimming, but actually learning to swim to a level that is safe through schools.
And bringing in the school issue, Mark, the issue of the decline of the school pool often comes up. There was an article a couple of years ago saying that in the past 5 years, about 165 school pools had closed and about 135 at risk. Is this an issue as well, the slow decline of the school pool?
Yeah, look, there is definitely a decline in school pools. But going back to the 8 hours, isn't 8 hours in the water. That's just if they have to talk about water safety. You know, and talking about it is all very well, but it also has to be practical. Closure of school pools. Look, it's a little bit of a bugbear of mine. Most school pools are not appropriate to teach accordingly anyway, and they're taught by school teachers, with all due respect to them, are not ever educated appropriately to teach swimming lessons. And so they go along to the school. It's an outdoor pool. It's often, I mean, we've had an incredible summer up here in Auckland, and you know, you can't fault that, but, you know, it's often you go into the pools, there's wind, and the teachers don't want to get wet. They're trying to control 30 kids in a class of all mixed abilities. And I can tell you, kids that are in lessons on a continuous basis versus kids that are petrified of the water that happen to be in the same classroom will be in the pool together, and it's a very small pool, and it's just not going to be conducive to those lessons.
Mark, it is really great to have you on. We've had a big response to this, so hopefully we can talk to you again sometime on the panel. I appreciate your time.
I'd love to.
That is Mark Bone. He's a former Olympic swimming trainer. He's at a swim school. It's called Swimtastic. Okay, so could you swim 800 metres? Scylla says, yes, I could swim 800 in a pool. The ocean's different. Big waves and no wall to push off. Jill, yes. I swim a K each day. I'm 75. 15-year-old daughter Neve, yes, can swim. 50-year-old Irish mum, definitely not. Everyone needs free swimming lessons. Wallace, I definitely could not swim 800 metres, maybe 100. 800 metres easy, says someone. No, I couldn't swim that easily. Someone says, I can't walk 800 metres. I train twice a week, easy for me to swim 800 metres. So, yeah, there's a big response to that. But, Alexia, how did you learn to swim?
My mother sent me off to Mrs. Lai's swimming school at Hauraki Corner for a long, 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 long time. But also I loved the water, so I just would be in there.
Oh, you do?
Whenever I could. Yeah, I'm a real water baby.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, Wallace, whatever happened to the lotto swimming lessons? Do you remember that? When my kids were little, we got free lessons in the summer by signing up to the lotto scheme. It'd be great to see
That's right. They keep coming. Julian says, no way could I swim 800 metres. I can maybe dog paddle 25. I tried to learn, no avail. If I stick my head underwater, I gasp. I don't even like having water near my face under the shower. I figure that as I don't have gills, I might as well just stay out of the water. So we might come back to this on the week and actually, is there an easy way to learn?
That's a good point.
How to swim, yeah. FYI, in Dunedin schools, children get 16 free lessons per year by qualified instructors. It's paid for by the Ministry of Education, so surely this is available nationwide. You're on the panel at RNZ National, 29 past 4. You're with Simon Pound and Alexia Russell this afternoon. I wanted to bring this up. A panel of three federal court judges in Melbourne has refused to reinstate the visa of the world tennis number one so that Novak Djokovic can stay in Australia. His application to the court has been dismissed, meaning he will be deported. The decision was unanimous and Djokovic was ordered to pay the legal costs of the government. He said, I'm extremely disappointed with the court ruling to dismiss my application for judicial review of the minister's decision to cancel the visa, which means I cannot stay in Australia and participate in the Australian Open. Meanwhile, the issue has thrown a light on the more than 30 asylum seekers who languish indefinitely at the Park Hotel, a secure site known as the Park Prison, where there's no such escape. And I wanted to go around the panel and ask, what did you make of this 11-day-long saga? Is it fair that it is booted out, or was it put out to dry? Simon?
I think it's, you know, the media loves it because there's a celebrity and there's some conflict and it's a really simple thing to report. But, you know, it's kind of bananas. I wish we could just ignore the anti-vax messages because, you know, when it's 4% of the population and you are making it the lead story all the time, you're kind of lifting its significance way above where it should be. And the fact that anyone would be looking to someone who's good at tennis for any advice about what to do with vaccines and their public health response is as nuts is expecting to watch the Australian Open and have Dr. Ashley Bloomfield as the taking part in the finals. It just makes no sense at all. We should ignore them and keep listening to the experts.
What do
no
you
offense
think
to your tennis?
Yeah. What do you think, Alexia? Was this a some have called this a publicity stunt, a promotional stunt for Scott Morrison? No doubt, hugely grateful to have been granted this lever on public opinion during an election year. Said the Guardian, no, don't look over there at the inferno of COVID cases. Watch instead while I windmill Novak Djokovic around my head like a super healthy vegan celery juice action man. Do you think he was hung out to dry? Or
no, nothing fair enough. Scott Morrison does at the moment is distracting. I mean, the ridicule that he has come under for everything, including this, has just been crazy. And as for don't write stories about it because we should not say anything about it. This is the best story this year. This is the headlines alone are worth it. Return of Serb and the easy puns. But this is a classic example of what happens when you've got a federal and a state government. And we are so lucky in New Zealand that we're small enough not to be bothered with this. It's really obvious. Australia Tennis has gotten to the state government's ear and said, oh, yeah, he's had COVID. He'll be all right. You know, you'll qualify. He's come in thinking that. And, you know, the federal border guards have said, nah, off you go, mate. You know, an absolute classic disorganisation at every level in the Australian authorities side of it. And I don't think anything Scott Morrison stands up and says has kind of changed the complete disarray that they're in.
Yeah.
I mean, as for Novak's, yeah. I mean, he has been ridiculous. I mean, the guy had COVID and then went out to a kid's function and did media interviews.
Yeah, Simon.
He's been held up as a martyr.
Simon?
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. You wouldn't want him as the poster boy for your movement. But, yeah, I can't imagine how they let him in the first place. But, yeah, I really do think that it would be good if we could not just focus on a simple conflict. And there are a lot of stories in Australia that are a lot more important at the moment.
What do you think? Do you think it's fair that he was being booted out? But anyway, that's as it stands, a panel of three federal court judges in Melbourne refused to reinstate the visa of the world number one tennis so that he can stay in Australia. Big response to swimming, really big response to swimming. So we may well indeed come back to that before the end of the week. What about the Lotto sponsored Take the Plunge swimming lessons that our kids did in the 1990s? That was good. Is that what you're talking about, Alexia? I think that was what you were referring to exactly.
Yeah, both my kids benefited from that.
Mm-hmm.
It was great because we were really broke at the time. It was just absolutely fabulous, really. Mm.
27-5, the panel are NZ National, Alexia Russell and Simon Pound with me this afternoon.